Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Over the weekend, Facebook founder and chief executive Mark Zuckerberg issued a sort of mea culpa.
Facebook founder and CEO Mark Zuckerberg is now coming out in favor of stronger government regulation.
It says the internet needs some new rules.
For specific areas.
Harmful content.
Election integrity.
Privacy. Data portability.
Zuckerberg announced a new independent oversight agency that will review content moderation appeals.
So the company doesn't have to set those standards and is not accused of bias. Mark Zuckerberg thinks regulation is inevitable, so he's proposing what that regulation should look like.
In a Washington Post op-ed, Zuckerberg said government regulation needed to play a bigger role in reining in harmful content, stopping fake news, and protecting privacy on sites like Facebook. That sounds quite different from where Facebook was just 1 year ago.
This was a major breach of trust, and I'm really sorry that this happened. We have a basic responsibility to protect people's data, and if we can't do that, then we don't deserve to have the opportunity to serve people.
Mark Zuckerberg speaking to CNN last March after revelations that the data firm Cambridge Analytica had accessed information from as many as 87 million Facebook users without their knowledge. Since then, Facebook has promised change, increased transparency, and a user-centric path forward. And yet, Facebook continues to be mired in controversy. The Department of Housing and Urban Development has accused the company of allowing racial discrimination through targeted housing ads on its platform, and civil rights groups have criticized Facebook for not doing enough to rein in white supremacist content. Today, we're looking at how to regulate the social media giant. I'm Tanzina Vega, and it's The Takeaway. Issy Lepowski is with me today to talk through the latest in the chaotic and scandal-ridden world of Facebook, and she's a senior writer for Wired. Issy, thanks for joining us in studio.
Thanks for having me.
So, all right, let's take it from the top. We heard a lot about Zuckerberg's urge for more regulation. Why now? I mean, is he trying to save image? Is this the optics? Is he under pressure? What's that? What is this all about?
I think he really has no other choice. Over the last year, Facebook has just been battered by the public, by politicians, by regulators in the United States, in Europe. It's happening around the world. It started with sort of the fake news debacle that emerged during the 2016 election. Then we heard about a Russian propagandist running amok on Facebook. Then the Cambridge Analytica news broke. Last year, they had a massive data breach. It's just been one thing after another for Facebook. And so regulators are increasingly looking at ways to rein the company in. They're looking at privacy regulation. California has passed privacy regulation. So they sort of have no choice but to come around to this idea, because really what they want is to play a role in shaping this regulation. They don't want it to happen without their input. And I don't think that regulators and politicians necessarily want it to happen without their input. Obviously, Facebook knows this industry better than anybody, but they need to strike a balance where these laws aren't too favorable to Facebook that they actually protect consumers.
Do we have any sense of what regulation would actually look like on the platform itself?
So Facebook has instituted its own set of rules, right? So they've gotten a lot stricter about what is and what isn't permitted on the platform. These are their sort of content moderation guidelines that have been evolving and are constantly being reassessed. So that's sort of their internal regulation. They've also, since the Cambridge Analytica scandal, cut off developers from a lot of the data that they previously had access to. But then what Mark Zuckerberg is talking about recently is all the regulation that really needs to be put in place by government. These are rules around election integrity. What sorts of digital ads can run before an election without having to say where the money's coming from, right? We have pretty robust laws governing how television ads are distributed and the sort of disclosures that they have to have. We don't have the same thing for digital advertising. One reason we don't have that is because for a long time, Facebook lobbied against it. They told the FEC, you know, this is impractical. We can't be publishing these disclosures for every ad. There's too many of them. Well, guess what? Facebook has already started doing those disclosures on their own. They're just asking now that all platforms have to level the playing field.
Mark Zuckerberg has often talked about Facebook's mission, and I want to play a clip from 2017 where he's talking to my former colleague Lori Siegel at CNN about how he describes what Facebook is meant to do. This was from 2017. Let's take a listen.
So our new mission is to bring the world closer together. And for the last decade, our mission has been to make the world more open and connected. And we've been really focused on these ideas, giving everyone a voice and helping to connect people, especially with their friends and family. And I think those are really good things, and we're going to keep doing them. All right, we're definitely not done with that mission yet. But now, I just feel like we have a responsibility to do more in the world. Right? I mean, when you look at the world today, giving people a voice and helping people connect are good, and they've made the world better in a lot of ways. But our society is still very divided.
So, Issy, Facebook has brought together more than 2 billion users to its platform internationally. But this sort of pie-in-the-sky idea to combat divisiveness and bring people together, I don't know. I mean, it feels like Facebook is doing the opposite.
It does feel that way. It feels like Facebook has driven us all into these echo chambers where we're just talking to like-minded people. And in some countries, we've seen that can be really dangerous. You have Facebook fomenting violence in Myanmar and Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka even temporarily shut Facebook down because they didn't feel that they had a handle on controlling all of this violent rhetoric. So yes, Mark Zuckerberg's vision for a more open, inclusive, connected world has not necessarily panned out the way he wanted. Which is why he's now talking about building a new vision for Facebook, which is focused on privacy. It's focused on messaging. It's focused on if Facebook newsfeed is the digital town square, then he wants to build the digital living room where you have the private conversations with your friends and family. Now, the question is whether people are really going to trust a company like Facebook that has such a spotty history when it comes to privacy with these private conversations going forward.
Also screenshots, but we'll get to that in a minute. Facebook, you mentioned violence, and Facebook did struggle to manage, if you will, or contain the video of the man who shot and killed dozens of worshipers in 2 mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand recently. What are they doing to try and prevent that type of content from spreading online?
This is a really tricky problem for Facebook and for other tech companies. We saw YouTube struggle with this too. Facebook takes one approach, which is hashing videos that it knows are against its policies. Hashing is essentially giving that video or photo a digital fingerprint so that every time you try to upload it, you're automatically blocked. And we know that Facebook did block over 1 million uploads of this video within, I believe, the first 24 hours. But the problem is people are pretty smart and they know how to get around these sorts of parameters. So you might take a video of the video, right? You take it on your phone and it's recorded on, it's playing on your laptop. That looks different to Facebook's algorithm. So what they have to do is get a lot better at spotting those sorts of variations of videos. They've also floated some new ideas. For instance, Sheryl Sandberg said that considering what we know about some of these people who have caused the most problems on live videos, maybe there's a way that we can see if they have broken our rules in the past, we prevent them from going live in the future. So that might prevent people who are constantly problematic on Facebook from distributing even more problematic content in real time via live stream. Obviously, there are ways that that can go wrong, too, because sometimes people use Facebook's policies as sort of a way to punish other users. Even if they haven't broken the rules, they'll, you know, gang up on somebody and say that they have. So Facebook still needs to figure that out, but these are some of the ideas they're considering.
So we talked about violence on the platform, but there's also a question of what Facebook tags as offensive. There's been a big debate around what's considered white nationalism, white supremacy, Islamic terrorism, Islamophobia. Who makes these calls, Issy? And who decides at Facebook whether something is or isn't racially offensive or racist?
Right. So Facebook has a big team that analyzes its content moderation policies. And this is an enormous living document that's constantly evolving. This team is led by a woman named Monica Bickert. And they will assess, you know, Facebook's rules on a range of issues, from images of graphic violence to hate speech, as you were talking about. But the problem is a lot of times these policies follow something that's already gone wrong. So we saw Facebook evolve substantially with regard to how how it moderates, for instance, ISIS-related content. And this was largely driven by the fact that this was a national security priority under the Obama administration. They gathered with a lot of Silicon Valley leaders and said, we need your help. You are becoming recruiting platforms. We need you to crack down on this. And so the companies banded together and they agreed to start sharing some information about the content they were seeing. We haven't seen that same national security priority with regard to white supremacy. So I think that the policies of these companies sort of follows that. Now, Facebook has just recently announced that they will no longer allow white nationalist content on Facebook. For a while, they were reluctant to do that because they categorized white nationalism as an identity, right? No different from other identities that people are rightly proud of on Facebook and build communities around on Facebook. But Facebook says, you know, we've done our learning and we have realized that you cannot separate white nationalism from white supremacy. Maybe an obvious idea for some of us, but for Facebook, when they're making so many decisions that they feel have to apply to billions of people around the world coming from a range of contexts and cultures, it wasn't something that they were ready to jump on until now.
Also, you know, Facebook, we often say we are the product, right? Because we, the users, don't pay for it. And Facebook has always said it's free and it always will be. But there are advertisers who are paying to have space on Facebook. How do they feel, do we know, about the potential for regulation on the site? I mean, is it better for like a big advertiser to say, you know what, I'd much prefer to have my ad there without a white nationalist, white supremacist content next to it?
Sure. I think that's certainly an upside, but there are downsides. So for instance, Facebook has put in some parameters around election advertising. So now you can go in and see what everybody has spent on election ads, who they've tried to target, where they've tried to target them, every single ad that they have posted, and the content. And so that has really changed things for political advertisers because they say, well, now the competition can see what I'm doing. And not only that, but they have to make sure they're putting messaging out there, but that they're okay with everybody seeing, right? In the 2016 election, you could target an ad to a small slice of people and the rest of the electorate would never see it. Now it's all out in the open. So that's one way that advertisers have been a little bit wary of what Facebook's doing.
Reminds you of being in the living room and all watching the same ad together. Issy Lipowski is a senior writer at Wired. Issy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hey, it's AJ from Los Angeles. I was an avid Facebook user, but these days I won't go anywhere near it. I certainly wouldn't install their apps on my cell phone. It's a company built on false pretenses, and I believe they're bad for society at large. You know, if Star Wars had Facebook, C-3PO would be selling Luke's data to the Empire.
That isn't very reassuring.
Hi, my name is Erica. I'm calling from Santa Cruz, California. What do I think Facebook should change? And my answer is short, everything.
I'm Joe Alvarez, calling from Colorado Springs, Colorado. I just can't believe we allowed a 20-something-year-old college dropout to reinvent social interaction. Facebook should fix Facebook instead of asking for greater government regulation that would only squeeze out Facebook's competition and enlarge the social media giant's monopoly.
Hi, this is Megan from Akron, and I have actually been put in Facebook jail before for hate speech. What did that speech entail? Having a scholarly discussion about the phrase, men are trash. Yeah, women are trash actually was never flagged or removed at all. And it seems to be this well-known issue that Facebook's algorithm considers cis white males a protected class. This is a huge issue and it needs to be resolved.
Good stuff, everybody. Keep it coming at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Two months ago, politics in the Commonwealth of Virginia came to a screeching halt. It started when the far-right media outlet Big League Politics published a racist image from Governor Ralph Northam's medical school yearbook page. The governor backtracked on initial claims that he was in the photos, but later admitted to wearing blackface in another incident when he was younger. Then, Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax was accused of sexual assault by multiple women. And followed by the Attorney General Mark Herring, who also admitted to wearing blackface in college. All three top Democrats in the state were embroiled in scandal at the time, and loud calls for their resignations, especially Northam's, erupted in Virginia and beyond. But today, all three remain in office. And after a period of hiding, Northam is reemerging for business as usual as governor. So we have Corey D.B. Walker, a professor at the University of Richmond, to help us break this down. How are you, Corey?
I'm doing well. How about you?
I'm okay. Thank you. And kind of interested in why we haven't seen any consequences here. You know, Governor Ralph Northam seems to have or is reemerging politically recently. And I'm wondering how that is being taken by Virginians, particularly Black residents.
Well, most Virginians are still asking for the governor to resign. The Congressional Black Caucus here in the Virginia legislature continues to maintain and hold its position. Most of the congressional delegation continues to maintain their position that the governor should resign. However, over the past couple of months, what we've seen is the governor reemerge on the political scene and attempt to conduct business as usual.
What about Attorney General Mark Herring? What is the position on him right now?
Well, Mark Herring's position, most individuals had not asked for his resignation. And Mark Herring, because he came out and confessed and because of the way in which he handled the situation, and there were no images, public images of it, so it wasn't seared in the public imagination. And Mark Herring has a bit of a strong progressive legislative stance. We haven't seen any calls for his resignation, and he's continued to do his work in an admirable manner.
You know, one of the things that we've been talking about, not just on this show, but in the country over the past couple of years, is racism, specifically American racism and our past with that racism. And I'm wondering, how were these two men able to just, I mean, did they just wait the scandals out, hoping that this would blow over? And if so, how do you feel about that?
I think that's part of the American calculus in terms of politics. It is see if one can wait the rush of the scandal as soon as it breaks, see if you can hold your position, see if you can offer some sort of apology, some sort of mea culpa publicly, and then you move on from there. However, what it does do is it sets a precedent for state politics that in matters around race and in matters around racial animus, you may just have to just sit out and wait for a little while and then see if you can't continue a few weeks or a few months later.
I'm going to ask a specific question about Black residents in Virginia, but I'm sure this can extend to any resident of Virginia who feels that these images were racist. Doesn't that approach take Black constituents for granted in many ways?
Well, there's a way of looking at it, and I think African Americans have made a political calculus on it. And in many ways, you have to look at the politics on the ground. If we had the resignation of all three of the leaders of Virginia state government, then we would have had a Republican in office. And the Republican Party, as we've seen in Virginia over the past few years, have not been friends to African Americans. So there was a pragmatic split in terms of how do we deal with this as a political matter, and then how do we deal with this as a matter around culture, redress, and responsibility.
Corey, I want to turn a minute to the other scandal that's happened in the state of Virginia. Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax has been accused by two women of sexual assault. Both of those women were interviewed by CBS this week. And I want to play a clip of one of those women, Vanessa Tyson, in her interview with Gayle King.
I hoped that there would be some sort of action. My concern is that you have someone in a position of leadership who has the ability to affect legislation on how these issues will be handled. And he himself is a predator.
Where does Fairfax stand with Virginians today?
I think the lieutenant governor is in a very precarious situation. What we've seen in terms of the two interviews from Dr. Tyson and Ms. Watson, as well as the inability of the lieutenant governor to deal with this situation in a manner that is very responsive, in a manner that is highly indicative of the situation that we're in and as a society and our Me Too moment. And the lieutenant governor using the language of lynching around this really does not bode well and really replays some of the more deleterious images that we have in American public life. And this hasn't played well throughout Virginia. There have been calls for his resignation. There have been recently, as of last week, there was an extensive column in the Richmond Times-Dispatch around violence against women and violence against African-American women, calling on the lieutenant governor to respond to this in not just a manner in which, let me go out and take a polygraph, but the lieutenant governor has to resign. He's lost a legitimacy and the ability to represent the Commonwealth of Virginia.
Corey, let's expand this, because the Democratic Party has also had its own issues with its own Me Too moments. I'm thinking Al Franken, more recently Joe Biden, although just to be clear, that's not an accusation of sexual assault, but an accusation of inappropriate behavior. What is the lesson here for Democrats at the national level?
Well, what the lesson for Democrats at the national level is that these issues are not ephemeral issues. These are not ancillary. These are core issues that affect the party. And if the party wants to identify with the insurgent movement that's growing throughout the nation around equality, radical equality for African Americans, for women, for minorities, if the party wants to stand up for social justice in a robust sense, particularly on matters of the economy and on matters of immigration, that it has to pay very close attention to these issues, and it has to be more than just a policy position or a rhetorical statement.
I mean, it seems particularly hypocritical from a political standpoint, at least. And I'm wondering, is this going to play out with Virginia voters?
Well, I think Virginia has a great progressive heritage. I look at some of our national figures, Representative Bobby Scott, the way in which he's continued to stand at the forefront. We have some great statewide leaders, particularly thinking of State Senator Jennifer McClellan. So I think we're seeing some movements, some very strong progressive movements in and around Virginia. What Virginia has to do to solidify that is it has to make a stand on where the governor, lieutenant governor, and the attorney general go from here. It can't be just a stasis. It can't be, well, the governor is going to stay in office for the next 4 years and the lieutenant governor is going to stay there, because what will happen is Virginians will then have to figure out, where does it move from here? Does it just continue to just say, well, we just want power to stay in power? Or is it, do we want power to do something to affect a broad and deep democratic society that we aspire towards?
Corey D.B. Walker is a professor at the University of Richmond. Thanks so much, Corey.
Thank you.
Hey, you, podcast person, Amy Walter here, host of Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway. Every week, I'll take you beyond the headlines for a deeper understanding of how Washington works, who's pulling the levers of power, and how it all impacts you. I hope you'll check it out. Just search for Politics with Amy Walter in your podcast app and subscribe. Happy listening.
This is The Takeaway with Tanzina Vega.
Wow, your wrists are tiny.
Oh,
you actually have a really small frame. There is a small person inside of you dying to get out.
Oh, well, I hope that small person's okay in there.
I know, it can seem impossible, but you can do this. You weren't meant to carry around all this extra weight.
Wow, very cool.
That is a clip from Shrill, a new show on Hulu based on a memoir by Lindy West. It's about a young woman played by comedian Adie Bryant who decides to change her life without changing her body. The show has been lauded by some media critics and feminists as a turning point in how fat women are portrayed in pop culture. And my guest today, Samita Mukhopadhyay, is the executive editor of Teen Vogue and the author of an op-ed that calls the new series, quote, a revolution for fat representation. Samita, welcome to The Takeaway again.
Great to see you, Tanzina.
I almost couldn't hold in the laugh from that clip because it was all just too much. So let's start with what your take on this is. It's a revolution for fat representation. Why?
One of the things that's really exciting about what Shrill is doing isn't as much what they are saying, it's what they're not saying by having a fat character, right? This character is about, you know, her own life, her day-to-day, dealing with guys that are toxic. She's trying to get ahead at work. She also happens to be fat. And I think the kind of portrayal of the internal life of a fat woman that's not dedicated to losing weight, that's not dedicated to self-hate, or she's not a sidekick, right? She's the main character. She's not the butt of jokes. And I think that that is a turning point in terms of, it's a very subtle shift, right? It's a very subtle shift to say, hey, what else is this woman about other than just trying to, as this trainer is obnoxiously trying to tell her, release the small person inside of her.
Also, like, what I love is that she's punching back, right? There are these moments, especially in that interaction, where I think she's kind of like, wait, what? But then she punches back really hard in a way that I wasn't expecting, to be honest, in all areas of her life, in her love life, at her job. And I found that revolutionary in and of itself, just as a woman.
Completely agree. And I think, you know, Lindy West's work really has been about that transformation. It's about, you know, what happens when you have experienced a form of discrimination all throughout your life, in this case, fat phobia, what internal processes do you have because of that? You internalize that anger. And I believe Shrill is really the output of that, of kind of processing that anger and having it inform your behavior and saying, no, I've had it. My voice is important. I have something to say. As a result, she's advocating for herself in the workplace, right? In ways that are, you know, extremely relatable outside of her body, outside of her kind of lived experience. I similarly in her love life, right? Who among us could not relate to that character?
Who, by the way, also has a very evolved storyline, I thought, for the lame boyfriend or whatever he is. I was kind of intrigued by the fact that they gave him a more realistic storyline, right? Rather than, yes, you're great, or no, you're a jerk.
Agreed. Yeah. And the actor is fantastic. I mean, he's great. And, you know, I do think that's very relatable to a lot of women in their 20s and 30s, these guys that kind of don't really have it together. They want to show up. They're really nice. But they can't really get the details right. As simple as taking you out to dinner or texting you back on time or showing up to the party you invited them to.
But they can do acid with your dog. But now, there is a question. I want to bring up the word fat, because I feel like when I was a kid, it felt like a pejorative. And now there's a scene here where she actually has this moment where she's like, this is what I am. I'm fat. And I think for so many women, whether we're fat or not, or whatever our thing is in the world, to be able to own that and say it. And there was just a sense of release and relief when she said that. I mean, what do we take for the word fat? Like, its evolution. Where are we today with that?
To be honest, I appreciate that optimism. I actually think fat still is a bit of a dirty word. And I think the majority of, especially women, would really shy away from identifying as it, or when most people describe someone as fat, it's not in a positive light, right? And we can see that anywhere from the medical system to comedy to, you know, all these different spaces where we talk about bodies and we talk about weight. Fat ultimately is not something that I think people celebrate as much as they could. I do think there's a growing movement, right? And I think that Shrill is in many ways the peak of that movement of women that have said, no, I am fat. And that is, you know, almost neutralizing the term. It is a descriptor. The same way that I'm a woman of color, the same way that my class background, the same way that I describe my gender, fat is a descriptor. And there is also this opportunity to say, and that's okay.
And the amazing thing is she looks amazing in this series as Teen Vogue executive editor. That has to matter. The fact that she is dressed impeccably and beautifully throughout, you want to wear what she's wearing. And she's also desired, which is something that I haven't seen often in film or any media, particularly for fat women. Like this desire, the sex scenes, this all of it just felt so refreshing.
Absolutely. Her outfits and kind of styling were fantastic. It is worth noting that she wasn't able to wear anything off the rack. Designers were not able to give her. Everything she wore was a custom look. So that does kind of call into question this idea of this effortlessness. It wasn't effortless, right? She wasn't able to just go into a store and buy, especially that sequin dress that she wears to that party
that
everybody must have. You know, all these looks were custom made. So as much as we are kind of embracing this idea of fat and we want to centralize it, ultimately the industry has not caught up. And by that, I mean culture, I mean fashion. Most forms of representation haven't kind of caught up to this.
I mean, we've heard designers say that they won't dress people over a certain size. And that size is what, like an 8 or some like monstrosity like that? Like, where is the industry headed? I mean, where is fashion when it comes to fat women?
It's not where it needs to be. Ultimately, there are designers. I don't want to downplay the designers that really are kind of embracing this moment. They recognize that there is an opportunity, first of all, and there's a business case here. These women, fat women, are the majority of women, right? The majority of women are above a size 16. And so there is a huge economic opportunity and possibility for kind of serving these audiences and serving this particular customer. Ultimately, though, until we disassociate fat as being disgusting and fat as being anti-fashion or against what we consider beautiful, the industry isn't going to shift, right? It has to both come from a cultural, it has to be a cultural shift, but it also has to be, we have to see leaders that say, no, this is beautiful as well. Like,
and what about fat when it comes to different communities? Because this is seen through the lens of a white woman. We know that in communities of color, weight can often mean different things. It can be celebrated in different ways. So how do we sort of look at the cultural factors involved and how we deal with fatness?
Absolutely. There are different standards based on class and geography. Right? What's considered fat in New York is different than what's considered fat in Chicago. I think those are all relative to specific areas. But ultimately, the kind of, you know, the bigger what we kind of look up to, what we aspire to be ultimately is thin, right? It is white. And I think that if you're living within the kind of American cultural context, no matter what your race is, no matter what your kind of ethnic background might be or where you live or what your kind of class background is, you're still pummeled with these images of what beauty looks like. And it is very hard. And I will say this as a woman of color and majority of my friends who have kind of grappled with this, they are still impacted by those images. And so, yes, there are, I think, moments and spaces where it is acceptable to have a larger body, right? Say in hip hop culture, right? Where you are constantly kind of elevating, but that's still a form of objectification. It's still a form of objectification, and it's still not defined by women kind of taking ownership of their own beauty and their own body. And ultimately, we are impacted by these images.
Samantha Mukhopadhyay is the executive editor of Teen Vogue. Great to talk to you again.
You as well.
That's it for us today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
Hey, everyone. If you like what you hear, if you have tips for stories, or if you just want to connect with us, tweet us at The Takeaway or give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE.